Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
Tracking the threat of asteroids before they get too close. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. What's the likelihood of an asteroid colliding with our planet? Well, NASA has a team of planetary protectors that are working to prevent just that, and we'll speak with NASA's Kelly Fast about how that team works to keep us in the know about potentially hazardous asteroids. Then, we revisit a conversation with journalist Lauren Grush about her book, The Six, The Untold Stories of America's First Women in Space. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? NASA's Planetary Defense Coordination Office works to protect our planet from any universal threats like asteroids and to, quote, find them before they find us. So how do they do that? Well, here to help answer that question and let us know just how worried we should be about asteroids is Kelly Fast, the program manager for NASA's Near Earth Objects Observation Program. Last week, we, on our Halloween episode, I had a group of physicists come on and tell us some of the scariest things about the cosmos. And one of our guests, Professor Josh Caldwell, said the potential of asteroids striking the Earth is particularly scary. And he did scare the crap out of me during our conversation. So I'm going to start first with, should I be worried about an asteroid strike on this planet while I'm still alive?
Well, I would say that at least those of us in the Planetary Defense Coordination Office and our Planetary Defense Officer, Lindley Johnson, likes to say, you know, we don't stay up at night worrying about such things. It's the sort of thing that's a very low likelihood of it happening in our lifetimes, something that could impact, that could cause a lot of damage. But at the same time, we have the ability to look, and so we should. But there are so many things, you know, that we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis, you know, other natural disasters like hurricanes, tornadoes, all that. We just went through a pandemic. You know, obviously, those are the things that we're always dealing with. But it's good to think about asteroids also because it is the only natural disaster that could actually be prevented. And so we don't know unless we look. And so it's the sort of thing, it should be at the kind of the right level of concern. We have the ability to look. Let's look. Let's plan, but it should not keep anybody up at night.
Okay. I wish you were on the show last week because it's been a rough week for me.
Well, people like to sensationalize this topic, and it really should not be, but it is something that's worth looking at. And so that's why NASA does this.
So you mentioned there's kind of observation and prevention. So let's kind of break that down. You mentioned there's other things. I'm here in Florida. I'm used to hurricane season. Our weather forecasters have a 24/7 look at our planet and what's happening when it comes to the development of hurricanes and can track them, and we can see them all the time. How do you observe threats like near-Earth asteroids? Is it kind of the same? Are these satellites just pointed outward from our planet?
That's a way of looking at it, just like with watching for hurricanes. You know, you don't know unless you look. And so there's that global coverage of the Earth to watch as storms develop and then to track them. And in planetary defense realm, it's using telescopes to survey the skies looking for asteroids. You know, some are closer than others. And we're playing, in a way, tag around the sun, where the Earth is going around the sun, the asteroids are going around the sun. And so sometimes they're closer to the Earth and sometimes further away. And so it's not something that you could see in maybe, you know, in one instance, like with a hurricane, where you look at the Earth and you see there's one there. You kind of have to look over a long period of time, because sometimes some asteroids come into view, the telescopes, and can be picked up, and then you get enough information so that you can put them into the catalog. So it's a longer process, but it is similar. We have telescopes that survey the skies looking for the asteroids. And again, they're far away. Even in a telescope, they just look like a point of light, just like the stars, except they're moving with respect to the stars. And it's that motion, by studying that carefully, and then other telescopes that continue to follow up those first observations and get more observations to see how they're moving. There are teams that turn those motions into orbits, and then you can predict where those asteroids are going to be in the future. And so kind of like with the hurricanes, you know, you've seen those,
the spaghetti models.
The spaghetti models and then the cones of uncertainty and everything. Similar with the asteroids, where you can predict the orbits, and, you know, and space is very big. The odds of an asteroid and the Earth being at the same place at the same time are very slim, but over very long time scales, you know, it's going to happen at some point, but it isn't, you know, we actually get impacted all the time with stuff, but it's all very small. You see shooting stars or maybe a fireball, and there's more of all of that stuff out there. It's the bigger things that could cause damage that we want to find and track, and then just, you know where it is, and then maybe it's not a concern. But we're still finding more asteroids. The teams are still finding them. And so we have to kind of keep the work going so that if there is something that poses a threat, we're going to find it as early as possible, because then you've got all of that time to plan.
These satellites, these telescopes that you mentioned, are they specifically for the purpose of tracking these near-Earth asteroids, or is it someone who may be looking at something else and sees something moving a little quicker than the other stars, and they call you and say, hey, Kelly, you might want to take a look at this? How does it work?
It might be a little of both, because these telescopes that survey the skies have wide fields of view, so they're looking at these wide swaths of the sky, as opposed to like telescopes that maybe zero in on a particular object. So they're looking at larger swaths of the skies, looking for those moving objects. But in some cases, it is for the purpose of planetary defense. NASA funds the Pan-STARRS and ATLAS surveys at the University of Hawaii and the Catalina Sky Survey at the University of Arizona. And that's what they're doing. But they also pick up other things happening in the universe, like outside of the solar system. At the same time, telescopes that are maybe studying things outside of the solar system, astrophysics, transients and such, supernovas and all that, sometimes they'll pick up asteroids. So it can go both ways. But we like to say asteroids are really good photobombers. And so often they will photobomb any, you know, lots of observations that are happening for other purposes. But these surveys are really designed to pick up asteroids, but also to track to get enough information. It doesn't really help if you see an asteroid once, because that doesn't really tell you where it's going. You have to get enough observations to be able to get an orbit. Then it's actually useful to you.
And is it just asteroids you're concerned about, or is it other things like maybe comets or other particular other objects that might scare me that you're looking for?
Well, in planetary defense, we just stick to the natural small bodies. And so those are the asteroids and comets. But at the same time, we would want to pick up any small body that our survey can pick up. Often, a lot of the telescopes used for asteroid discovery and planetary defense, they pick up all kinds of asteroids that aren't near-Earth asteroids, new discoveries in the asteroid belt or beyond. And so there are small bodies throughout the solar system. And so actually, through this work, you get a lot of bonus science. But getting back to your question, the concern is about the natural objects, asteroids and comets, but it's really the asteroids that are more numerous and are more likely to cross Earth's orbit that we want to keep an eye on, but want to discover any natural bodies that we can.
Let's talk about the prevention, because if you see them and there is one that could potentially threaten us, what are our options at this point? I mean, we can't slow down or speed up our planet's orbit to miss this thing. What can we do?
Well, the thing, again, like with the hurricanes, that gives you the most power is the time. And so the whole goal of NASA's Planetary Defense Program is to discover these objects early so that you do have options. So if there is an object that does pose a threat, that you'd have years or decades of notice instead of, you know, like in the movies, everybody's always scrambling. And it takes time anyway to get enough observations to really nail down an orbit and a prediction. So first of all, just doing it early. So we have the ground-based telescopes that are working it, like the ones I mentioned. NASA is developing the Near-Earth Object Surveyor mission, which is a space-based infrared telescope, which will really speed things up in terms of the discoveries and be very complementary to the ground-based telescopes. So all of that will help to have the luxury of time, because then we get into, you know, what might you do about it? Let's say we did find an asteroid that posed a future impact threat. You know, if it was very small, you know, our atmosphere actually takes care of a lot of things for us. So we've actually had some warned impacts. An asteroid was discovered, you know, hours or a day before impact. We're talking something very small, like a meter in size. It just makes a pretty fireball. But it was a wonderful exercise of the system to see, are all our predictions correct and everything? Okay, great. You know, if we didn't have the time, let's say, to send a deflection mission, there's working with other agencies in the government. I mean, NASA's role is getting that information and helping to disseminate and coordinate. But there actually is a national strategy for planetary defense. So NASA would engage with other agencies like FEMA we work with regularly. This isn't the most important thing they think about, but we don't want it to be the first time they think about it. Other agencies have a role in planetary defense, and it would depend on, you know, where the impact might be. But let's say it's something where we have an opportunity to not have the Earth affected at all. We have like a deflection mission, kind of like what you saw with the test mission that the DART mission was recently, to see if we could deflect an asteroid. When I mentioned the luxury of time, if you could deflect an asteroid very early, then you don't have to deflect it as much. You don't need as much in your energy to deflect it. And so if you have a lot of time, you can talk about a deflection mission like a kinetic impact or as DART was, where you just, you know, smack something into the asteroid, change its orbit slightly so that all you have to do is make sure that the asteroid and the Earth are not at the same place at the same time. And again, as our planetary defense officer likes to say, he'd rather move the asteroid instead of the Earth. And it's a whole lot easier.
Finally, Kelly, I mean, we talked about making these observations, having the luxury of time, the ability to move these asteroids if we need to, with some of the findings that you and your colleagues are getting from the DART mission. What are still some challenges that are on the horizon in planetary defense that you and your colleagues are working on, or what we can look forward to in the next maybe 5, 10, 15 years when it comes to this field?
Right. Well, certainly there's the whole kind of fundamental role, the bread and butter, the finding the asteroids. And we know we have not found all of the ones that could pose a threat to Earth. The nice thing is the really large ones, when people like to talk about like the planet killers or what have you, like the 1 kilometer and larger, the multi-kilometer asteroids, the ones that actually approach Earth, that population is pretty well known. There aren't many that are discovered every year. There's fewer of them. They're easier to find. So we're not so much worried about that. Impacts that could have global consequences. But the bar actually has been set by Congress for NASA to find 140-meter and larger asteroids. As you go smaller in size, there's more and more of them. And that's a size that, should they impact, they could pose, you know, regional consequences to the Earth, you know, maybe affect a whole U.S. state or become a national security threat or affect, you know, a smaller European or African country. We still want to find those. So that's the purpose of the Near Earth Object Surveyor mission, is to speed up what's already happening, because, you know, the telescopes that we're funding right now, they're really working to the limits of their capability, kind of have to wait for the asteroids to come to us to find them, to come closer, and that takes time. This will speed things up with a telescope that's in space, looking in the infrared, looking for the heat signatures with a different vantage point. Okay, so that will really help. But then some other issues. Let's say we did find something that posed a future impact threat, and we talked about deflection missions. But if you had, again, the luxury of time, you'd really want to understand a lot about that particular asteroid to even help you design your deflection mission. You know, more about its size, more about its composition. Is it kind of a rocky body, or is there more metal, like iron content? That could affect, you know, deflection or the effects it could have on Earth. And so if you had a lot of time, you could launch a reconnaissance mission, a characterization mission, a mission to go out there, you know, kind of like our science missions at NASA that study asteroids, to go out there and study the properties that would most help people who would design a deflection mission to be able to understand the object. But the thing is, we're used to launching science missions and the whole process we go through to really do that well. And that's fabulous. But let's say we had time, but we were still tight on time. Are there ways to go through our whole spacecraft development and launch process that can be optimized and streamlined more for planetary defense purposes? So exploring some topics like that, how do you get more information about a threatening asteroid once you find it? And how can you help to better design a deflection mission? DART was one demonstration of one deflection technique. It would be nice to also demonstrate other techniques. But there's still more to be done in terms of designing capabilities to be ready in the event that a threat is discovered.
Kelly Fast, thank you so much for putting my mind at ease this week, and also the efforts you and your colleagues are making to protect our planet. And thanks so much for joining us here on the show, Kelly.
Thank you for having me. Thanks so much.
That was Kelly Fast, the program manager for NASA's Near Earth Objects Observations Program. Still to come, chronicling the experiences of the first U.S. women astronauts. That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. The book, The Six, chronicles NASA's first women astronauts. Lauren Grush is the author of the book, The Six, and a space reporter for Bloomberg News. We're revisiting a conversation between Grush and our producer, Marion Summerall, about the book and the advances these first women made for the U.S. space program.
Well, Lauren, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's talk about this book a little bit. When you open the book, you read the line, "To the women who look up and dream of more." Tell me about why you picked that specific statement.
Well, it was just very important to me to pick a story that centered women. Just a little bit about me. I myself, you know, I'm a woman, obviously, in the male-dominated industry. While there are many great female journalists in the space journalism world, you know, when I first got started, I still felt a bit outnumbered. And so finding more women that I could relate to was really important to me. And, you know, I've always dreamed of writing a book, but when it comes to reporting on space, it still feels like a very male-dominated industry. And so it was very important to me to center women's voices. And so when I was thinking of, you know, who I wanted to dedicate the book to, it really kind of centered around that sentiment of the women that I have associated myself with in my life and the ones that I've grown to know by reporting on this field and also in the space industry themselves. They are the people that kind of inspire me and give me hope. And so that's what I was hoping to give back to them with that dedication.
Talk about the research that went into this book and going through the articles and the archives.
Yeah, there is a lot of there's a very rich history that's available if you know where to look. NASA did something very fantastic, which is this oral history project. So they were able to go back and talk with many of the astronauts, many of the executives and officials that were working during this time. And they were very open and honest with what the missions were like at the time, what the culture was like at the time. But a lot of the research also stemmed from going through old news articles in the archives, magazine articles. And so I really got a vivid account of how the press, our media ancestors, covered the women during this time. And that was probably the most eye-opening experience, because I think that really painted a picture of just how they were viewed, how people thought about them at the time, how they thought this was such an anomaly at the time. And, you know, I must give forgiveness for the press at the time in the 70s and 80s, because they weren't necessarily so enlightened in their questions and how they portrayed the women. But they definitely, there was a lot of coverage of them at the time. Another great resource was Johnny Carson. I went through his archives as well. Also a great representation of the jokes that were being made at the time. Not so, you know, I don't think anyone would be laughing at them these days. And if you go back and listen to them, they started groaning after a while. So yeah, it was a lot. And then, of course, NASA has a lot of great archival information on the missions that the women actually did. There's some great air-to-ground transcripts that I went through. Just a lot of great, you know, a variety of media that I was able to sort through and to really piece together a whole portrait of what these women's lives were like during this period of time.
Did it make you feel more connected to these six women when you were going through the research? And then when you did start writing the actual book, you know, how did that kind of go into play?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I really loved the most was obviously talking with the women and the TFNGs that I was able to talk to. It really did. And the TFNGs, just to relate, stands for the 35 New Guys. That was the astronaut class in which these women were selected. For those that were able to talk to me from that era, from that astronaut class, you know, it was fantastic. It really did feel like I was a fly on the wall sometimes in the 80s and the late 70s, getting to hear about their training, the stories that they remember,
And also hearing the different stories from different perspectives, you know, certain people remember it one way, whereas other people remember it the other way. It is just a fascinating dive into how memory works and what stands out to people versus what doesn't. I really did feel like I got to be like a little ghost in the room during TFNG training back in the day. And it really did seem like such a fascinating and vibrant class to be a part of. And so I really am honored and touched that they shared so much with me.
I did want to talk a little bit about the first chapter, But Only Men Can Be Astronauts. And it talks about Margaret Ray Seddon not only wanting to follow her mother's path, but pursuing a path in STEM as a surgeon. You know, you made that kind of connection to the media of how the media has changed. But do you think that women today feel the same struggle when it comes to STEM and specifically having a space-related career like Margaret did?
I think that's what's so great about these women, right, is because hopefully because of their experience and what they went through, the women today don't have to deal with the same kinds of struggles. Obviously, there are so many things that we're still fighting for today, but that is why I ultimately wanted to write this book, is because in my own life, I think about the women who came before and have made it easier for me. That's ultimately what pioneers are for. And what I thought, what I found fascinating was that for the women themselves, depending on how old they were or what generation they were in at the time that they applied to be an astronaut, they had vastly different experiences of sexism and chauvinism. For instance, Shannon Lucid was slightly older than the other women when they applied. And the amount of, you know, chauvinism she had to deal with when she just wanted to work. All she wanted to do was to have a job that was in her field. I mean, she went to college and grad school for chemistry. You know, just having people take her seriously, she was just constantly told no. And so I really hope that because of the strides that we've made and the women that have made it easier for us, that women don't feel that same barrier that they might have felt in the earlier days. Of course, I do know, like I said, there's still a long way to go in terms of reaching parity. And I'm sure that has some significant effects when it comes on women feeling comfortable in male-dominated workplaces. But like I said, I think there's a lot more efforts that are being made today with certain fellowship programs that encourage women to go into STEM and into space and science. You know, one story that I like to bring up is like when I first went out to Cape Canaveral for a rocket launch, I was probably one of the younger people in the room. I was also one of maybe two or three women who were covering that launch. And so I very much felt extremely out of my element when I was there. I felt like more eyes were on me than normal. You know, it's just, it can be so isolating when you don't feel like there's anyone you can relate to in the room. And so that's what I really hope is helpful with this book is, you know, they had to go through it so that we didn't have to. And, you know, it's sad that that's the way that it is. And obviously, you know, this should have happened way earlier. But it is, you know, somebody did have to come first. And that's, you know, what this book is about.
Another part of the book with losing Judy in the Challenger explosion. I mean, it was devastating. It was heartbreaking. And how each of the six did their part to keep the space program alive. Can you give insight into why you think it was their priority to keep it alive and to hold different people accountable?
Well, I think when it comes to something you love, you can also want it to be better too. And I think that was true for Sally. You know, she loved the space program. She had great moments with the space program. But at the same time, I think you do have such an affinity for something. You can also see the cracks and the places where things can improve. And so I think for Sally, it was just really important to, you know, not let the astronauts' lives not lead to change. You know, obviously, she wanted to make something positive out of it. And I just think that's a great anecdote about, you know, just it shows how the women did stick up for each other in times when they really needed it. You know, one thing that I found interesting about the book is that I went into it thinking that, oh, they were all going to be just like best friends. And, you know, they are obviously super supportive of each other. And while they were, and they did come together as a unit, you know, they weren't like this girl group that I think maybe the press thought they might have been. And that's completely natural, right? What I really loved was that Sally and Judy were particularly close. And so really was a very touching moment for Sally to be able to help incite change from the accident that Judy tragically lost her life in.
You know, they all came together to support something that they really loved and seeing the cracks in it and making sure they speak out. And on the back of the book, it's a note from you saying that this story needs to be told. And when someone reads their stories and reads this book, what is the main message you want the reader to take away? You know, what would you as the author want that to be?
So it might sound really silly, but ultimately, I really just want people to come away realizing that the women were just people, you know? I think there probably is a lot of focus to kind of build them up as these heroes. And while they are in such a way, they really were just trying to do their jobs. And they just happened to be the first ones of their gender to do it. And so that's why I actually really, truly loved writing the chapters of their space flights, because it really, that was less about them as women, and it was really more just about them as astronauts performing their job and why they love to do what they do. And so I want people to take away, yes, you know, there are interesting aspects of this book where, you know, there were some, I guess, culture clashes and also some people that weren't so, you know, accepting of them. And while I did want to highlight that, I ultimately wanted to just, you know, just paint portraits of women who happened to be slotted into these pioneering roles. And that's ultimately what I want for us, you know, moving forward. And then that was what also the six wanted too. You know, the last thing they wanted was anyone highlighting their gender. They were all about being part, like one of the guys, essentially. They didn't want to be seen as like the girl astronaut or the woman astronaut. And I think that's ultimately what we all want as well. Now, as we move forward, I think, you know, we've kind of evolved in our thinking when it comes to this sort of thing. I think we're at a stage where we can celebrate being women and being different, but at the same time, not letting that be a hindrance in terms of how we can move forward in our lives and careers. And so, yeah, that's ultimately what I hope people take away.
If I were to also say, what did I take away? That'd be my statement as well.
Well, I just think this book is pretty timely because of where we are in our nation's space program right now. You know, for those that might not be following it, you know, NASA is in the midst of its Artemis program to send people back to the moon. And one of the stated goals of that program is to send the first woman to the surface of the moon. And I think that who they haven't selected her yet, but when they do, you know, obviously she's going to get a lot of attention, similar to way the Sally Ride did when she launched on STS-7. But I'm hopeful that because we've had, you know, the six have paved the way and have made it easier, the questions that they will get, that she will get, and the attention that she will get will be much more evolved and less of a spectacle than when Sally Ride flew. And so I think that's just a testament to the women that came before. And, you know, hopefully she'll have them to thank for that.
That was Lauren Grush, a reporter at Bloomberg News and author of The Six, The Untold Stories of America's First Women in Space. That interview first aired September 12th. Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit WMFE.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Alessandro Bonaiuto. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.